Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. This week, a fan favorite steps in to guest conduct your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra, and the concertmaster takes center stage. Joining me today are conductor Fabien Gabel. Welcome, maestro.
Hello.
And violinist Juliana Athade, who is another fan favorite, I might add.
Thanks, Julia.
So nice to have you back. So, the concert is actually going to begin with a work that has never been played by the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra. It's a suite by Bernard Herrmann. It's for the Hitchcock film Vertigo. Did you choose this, Fabien?
Yes, I was asked to perform some American music, and I conducted this piece earlier this season with my orchestra in Canada. And I thought it was a very good idea to play this music because Bernard Herrmann is one of the best music film composer, but he was also an eminent classical music composer too. And his music is very interesting, very romantic, very dramatic too. And it sounds great, really.
And so it does sound great. This is music that, even though it's been severed from the film, still works well.
Oh, definitely, because it's so well orchestrated. It fits for an orchestra alone without a movie. There are three movements, and each movement are rather short. But, for instance, the second movement is really influenced by Wagner's Tristan and Isolde music, the love scene. So, it works very well without the movie. And I think it's like some John Williams music. It's played more and more in regular concerts, in classical music concerts, because it's just great music. And so well orchestrated, so it works very well.
Have you watched many Hitchcock films?
A long time ago, but I can't remember really the which ones, so don't ask me.
So also on the program are two French works, and we'll start with Ducas La Perie. There's a fanfare. And then there's the main body of this. He calls this a danse poème. Have you ever seen the La Perie as a ballet?
No, never. I think it's been decades that nobody saw the ballet because it's never programmed. And but the poem for orchestra is disappeared a little bit, but now it's played more and more. It's been now 10 years. We can listen to that music quite often in various countries.
Can you give us the storyline of this?
Oh, this is a very simple story. That's the story of a prince in Persia, Iskander, and he's looking for the flower of immortality, and who owns the flower of immortality, that's La Perie. And after a long trip, he meets this Perie, and she's asleep, and is stealing the flower of immortality. And suddenly she's waking up, and she's in panic, and she's so beautiful, she can see on Iskander's face that is impressed by his beauty, so she's starting to dance around him in order to get the flower back. And of course, the prince is so in love and completely addicted to his dance. He's drunk. He's kind of drunk. And at the end, so she collects she gets the flower back. And that's the moment that the prince is aware that he's going to die. Voilà. That's the story. Maybe it's difficult for me to explain in English, but that's roughly the story.
It made all the sense in the world to me. Now, the piece actually starts very quietly, or ends very quietly, rather. It begins past that fanfare, which RPM.
Which was composed after. Yeah.
Was it? So why was it used with it?
Sorry?
Why did he use it with it?
He composed the fanfare for the fanfare was commissioned after for a performance in Théâtre du Châtelet in Paris. And La Pairie was one of the piece in the program, but I think Ravel, Valse Noble et Sentimentale, or maybe another piece, I don't know, Florent Schmitt, La Tragédie de Salomé, and I forgot the other one, and all the composers composed a fanfare for this occasion. So I think he composed the fanfare 1 or 2 years after.
And it sticks with it from this day, that day on.
I like it very much because it's very brilliant and but not pompous. Pompous is like brass music sometimes. And this is really noble fanfare, and it stops and suddenly the poem starts, and there's an incredible atmosphere.
At the end of the poem, it's very quiet. And some conductors have said to me that conducting a piece that ends quietly is more difficult than one that ends with a roaring boom. Do you find that so?
I'm never asked to myself this kind of question. I think it's the challenge is to be delicate when you finish a piece very quietly. You have to build this very quiet ending. It's easier to finish a piece with a big boom, as you say. And I can't tell, really. It must be natural. If it's not natural, if you try to add an effect, even if it's very soft, it's not good. It should be very natural.
So also on the program is a real favorite of everybody. Everybody loves it. Debussy's La Mer,
mm-hmm.
A piece that Debussy wrote when he wasn't even close to the ocean.
He started in the middle of nowhere in France, in Burgundy, and after he went to the Channel's coast, you know, the French. In France, you know, in northern France, and then he finished La Mer in Eastbourne, UK. Voilà. But it's evocation, you say that? Evocation of souvenirs from his childhood in the with Mediterranean Sea.
So he looked back at trips to the sea when he was a kid,
mm-hmm.
and he came up with this.
Mm-hmm. With this masterpiece.
It is a masterpiece.
Oh, it is. But I don't know. I don't know any piece any works by Debussy which is not a masterpiece. Maybe I'm not objective, but I think each piece is genius.
How does he capture light? Because this is the thing about La Mer, is that he manages to capture the light of the sky, the light of inside of all the waves that
yes.
shimmer. As it bounces off, you just get this great sense of sun and light.
It's like in paintings, he's doing like he uses the all the colors of the orchestra, and the way he orchestrated La Mer is, I would say, revolutionary. It's before Strauss's Salome, and 1 year before, so it's completely new. Completely new, the use of the winds, the string sections. They are playing sometimes like percussions, and there's a very clever and unusual way to use the harps and also percussion. So
yeah, it's like it's not just the orchestration, it's how he has the instruments play and, you know, muting the horns and the
yes,
different kind of sound that provides. And
It's a completely different sound than Brahms or a Brahms symphony or even a Tchaikovsky symphony. You know, you have the main melodies with the violins and maybe sometimes the second theme with winds or celli, I don't know. know this. Everything is spread in the orchestra. It's fantastic, really.
Giuliano, you've played both the Dukas and the Debussy in your time. I'd love your take on these two pieces of music.
Well, interestingly, I think it's possible that the last time the Dukas was scheduled, Christopher Seaman conducted it, and it may have been another time that I played a concerto, because I actually haven't played it. We've done it plenty of times where we have the brass players just do the fanfare, but I've never actually played the main body of the work, so I'm really thrilled to hear it.
Cheated again.
Yes, I mean, it's actually sad. There are pieces that frequently come up. One that kept escaping my clutches with the RPO, Brahms 4, kept coming up when I was playing concertos, and I was so heartbroken because I love it. And actually, when Fabian was working on this program, when he said he was going to do La Mer, I at first said, maybe I could play the second half. I don't want to miss La Mer. He says, well, you can do it if you want. Let's just say the Bartok is enough of a task, and I will be happily in the audience, but very regretful to miss playing La Mer with you.
Why do you love playing La Mer?
I mean, for the same reasons that he's talked about. I love the colors in the orchestra. I love how clearly it tells a story and, like you said, paints a picture. Actually, I teach some of La Mer in my orchestral repertoire class at Eastman because it's a great work that we put on symphony orchestra auditions frequently because we need to hear if people can play this style. I think the style is something so different to most of the music we play orchestrally.
The articulation of the playing is completely different.
And the sound world and kind of how you create that. There's a very main cello excerpt. So string players are always striving to find the right color and the right sound, right articulation, pacing for Debussy. And so I think for the orchestra to have this chance to work on it with you is great for us.
Where does your excerpt come? There are the three movements from Dawn to Noon on the Sea, then Play of the Waves, and finally Dialogue of the Wind and the Sea. Where do you know which...
Play of Waves, second movement.
Yeah.
Probably.
We have, actually, this is very interesting. We have a very short excerpt. Literally, it takes 23 seconds to play.
But it's really... That's the second movement, yeah.
And it is so, so difficult. My students in my class this year, they couldn't believe it. They said, this is only 23 seconds, and it is so difficult. We actually spend a few weeks just working on Debussy because it's almost... like learning a new language for them.
That's exactly the. That's why this music is difficult, because for most of the players in every orchestra in the world, this is an uncommon language, the French music, and in particular Debussy. Debussy is much harder to play, to perform than Ravel in terms of understanding. Ravel is very obvious and it's very natural. Debussy is not natural. It sounds great, really, and it's really perfectly orchestrated, but is fighting all the time. Ravel, it's super easy when he's composing. When he composed, it was really easy. Not for Debussy. He needed time. And he corrected his works many times.
And is somebody who doesn't get the chance to sit on the stage because I frankly have no talent and I sit in the audience, I think about what it must have been to have heard Debussy for the first time. Because if the language is new for you as a conductor and you as a violinist at the time, what about the ears that never had heard those sounds before?
Well, right. I mean, we have such a, I think orchestral music has such a Germanic tradition, and of course, you know, Tchaikovsky symphonies, romantic, and Brahms symphonies, and those require big, full, lush sounds. Debussy requires some editing. In other words, players have to hold back, I would say, and find a way to emote without pushing the sound. You know, it has to, instead of it being right in the listener's face, it has to ask the listener to come in. And when someone leans forward and wants to hear, I mean, I was watching some of Fabian's rehearsal of La Mer the other day, and I was thinking, oh, I've played this so many times, I've heard it so many times, fine. And all of a sudden, he's bringing out things that I had not really noticed. You know, and so it's about this textural component. And I think that's one of your great gifts, knowing what to bring out when and how to shape and shade.
It's a question of taste, too, maybe because that's my taste and that's what I like to do in that music. But you were saying that this language is not new to me. I always heard the music of Debussy and for most of the French musicians, it's rather natural to play that music. But as you said, you have to contain yourself sometimes. But Debussy is also very deeply influenced by Wagner and also by the Russians. So sometimes you can give more, but suddenly you have to hold back. That's the big difficulty.
It's this restraint when you're in the middle of playing something you love.
Because, for instance, his opera Parsifal, Pélas and Mélisande, was really influenced by Wagner's Parsifal. And you can listen to the harmonies are very similar, and the texture, the sound of the strings must be similar. It's not on surface, but it's really deep. But sometimes you need to relieve the sound and to hold back and play a little bit less and to play with a lot of precision and articulation.
And this brings us to your solo. You mentioned it already. You're playing Giuliana's solo, your solo in Bartok's Violin Concerto No. 2, which was actually the only Bartok violin concerto for years. It wasn't until 1956 that they actually dug out No. 1. You said, Giuliana, that this is a bucket list concerto.
Yeah.
So others have said that it's one of the greatest violin concertos of the 20th century. So what makes this so great?
Well, I wouldn't disagree with that. You might be surprised, or our listeners might be surprised, to know that I actually did learn the other, or now called the first, Bartok concerto when I was in high school. And I loved that piece. They really couldn't be more different, the two concerti. But I first got to know the second concerto when I think I was maybe 13 or 14, and I was concertmaster of the San Francisco Symphony Youth Orchestra, and we would rehearse at Davies Hall, where the San Francisco Symphony plays, and we would rehearse Saturday afternoons, and they would have kind of a group of tickets for students if they wanted to stay after rehearsal and go to a concert. And so I stayed as often as I could, and I heard Midori play this second Bartok concerto, and it really was the first time I'd ever heard it. I hadn't heard a recording of it or anything, and I experienced it live, and I just was blown away. It was such a guttural response for me. I find Hungarian music very irresistible in its earthiness, and kind of the combination of this romantic lyricism, but then these folk tunes that are very active and energetically rhythmic. So I immediately thought, oh, I want to learn this someday. And I actually would play that first page. I would play it. I didn't have the music. I would just play it by ear. I listened to this recording over and over, and I just wore it out. You can imagine I was surprised when I finally did start learning it. Oh, there's a few notes in there that I wasn't playing by ear correctly. So it's been really a joy. I was thrilled when I think it came at Fabian's suggestion that we should do this
piece. You wanted to do the first.
Well, I said, we could do the first. Secretly, I wanted to do the second, but I thought, who's going to agree to program this enormous piece?
But I wanted to do the second one because I didn't know the first one. That's probably why. I ask you, but it's a good piece.
So you have never played this before?
So I have never played this before. Like I said, I always wanted to learn it. It was never the right time when I was studying in college and grad school. Of course, by grad school, I was preparing for major orchestral auditions. And while we do occasionally hear people play this concerto in an audition, it's not very common, and kind of, I would say, my bread and butter at an audition is always Brahms concerto. I love to play Brahms. So the Bartok kind of waited. And then once you become a professional, you suddenly are really learning the things that pertain to work, and you don't have a lot of spare time to learn other things. I had imagined, you know, if I get a really great student at Eastman, I might assign them the piece and then I would learn it with them. And, you know, that it didn't come up yet. It wasn't right for my students yet. And so when this came up, I thought, okay, this is going to be awesome and a huge responsibility. Some of our listeners may know I have one child, and I thought this was a bucket list item I could achieve while I have one child, but not something I might like to take on someday when I have two children. No, I'm not telling our listeners anything, but
stupid question, and this is just a dumb question. Have you memorized this?
I am not playing this for memory, and I had a great conversation actually with James Ennis, who was here earlier this year playing Beethoven concerto with us. And I was, you know, he was here in January, and I think maybe I'd learned the first page, and that was it. So he came over to the house, and we're talking through it, and he's looking at my first page and going, oh, yeah, the good fingerings. And he opens it, and he goes, oh, okay, you haven't gone further. I said, no, not yet. And I said, oh, man, do you think I need to memorize this? He said, absolutely not. And I thought, oh, amazing. I'm actually interested at how many people I've seen play this with the music. To me, I tell my students this, I feel strongly that you should only play something without music if the performance is enhanced by that fact. I don't think it's necessary to show that skill. Certainly audiences here have seen me play numerous concertos for memory, but I think in this case, the intricacies of the piece, both dynamically, lyrically, how involved the orchestra part is, the 2D passages are completely symphonic. It didn't feel to me that I would enhance my performance by playing it without the music, and I definitely don't feel that I'm losing anything by using the music.
So let's talk about that orchestral part. Juliana, you mentioned folk tunes. It sounds like folk tunes, but Bartok never uses an actual folk tune in this.
That's what we call reinvented folk music. It sounds like folk music, but he created a music which sounds like it. And but he knew exactly all the folk tunes of his country. Yeah.
And it's really the harmonies as well. It's not just, oh, we know that tune. It's the scales that he uses.
Yes, because it sounds like Middle Europa, what we call Middle Europa. It sounds really Eastern European and gypsy,
yes,
rhapsodic music. And that's the beauty of that music, I think.
It has the most beautiful and mysterious beginning.
Mm-hmm.
With a harp, yes, it's fantastic.
When we started rehearsing it today and I heard that, it just is like, gives you chills to think, I can't really explain. I think it is just magnificent. I think people will benefit from listening to it before the concert, but I also think it makes an incredible impact upon your first hearing.
I do think that this is one that should be listened to beforehand. First time I ever saw this performed or heard it was with Gil Shaham, and it was with the RPO, and I never heard this before, and I was absolutely plastered to my seat. I could not believe what I was seeing. It was extraordinary. Why don't you take us on a little bit of a road trip? We begin with this mysterious movement and end where. So what happens between the mystery and the finale.
Well, like I was saying, there's so much rubato in this music.
Explain rubato.
Okay, so rubato is, you know, if we're going along in one tempo, the composer asks for the musicians to kind of maybe loosen that up and allows for some give and take. It's not really spelled out, although I will say in this piece, Bartok is almost fanatical about his metronome markings, and they are so frequent. I have to say I'm glad that Fabian must have a wonderful internal metronome, because these tempo changes come so quickly. But even within the lyrical writing, he'll just ask for rubato, and that really gives a lot of freedom to the performer. So I think that's great. I love in the first movement that we're always going back and forth between these sensual melodies and then almost athletic passage work that is very interactive for the soloist in the orchestra. The second movement is a beautiful theme and variations. The opening melody is, I think, nothing short of angelic. And maybe you hear some of what he did in the first movement of the first concerto in that second movement opening. But I think the variations are so diverse. You have everything from mysterious, you know, quiet, kind of slow moving harmonies to there's a scherzando, you know, with flutes and winds and percussion. And then the last movement actually uses a lot of material from the first movement. It's interesting to know that Bartok, when he was approached by his friend Zoltan, for whom he wrote this piece, he wanted to write a theme and variations for violin and orchestra. And the violinist really pushed him. No, I want a concerto. So I think in the end, maybe they both won, because Bartok, definitely the second movement is theme and variations. But you could almost say the whole piece has a connection of variations on the first movement. So it's, I think the last movement is thrilling to listen to. And if something else on the program doesn't end with a boom, this ends with a boom.
Yes, and a big one. And a big one.
A big boom.
In listening to this, one of the things that caught my ear, Fabian, was the use of brass in the orchestra and a couple of moments that sound very close to something from Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra. There are spurts of brass.
Always in Bartok's music, he knows exactly how to use each section of the orchestra, and especially the brass and percussion. The Concerto for Orchestra was composed, I think, 9 years or 8 years after the second violin concerto. But I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. It's a very natural language and natural way to write for instruments, to use so many brass in the Wunderbare Mandarin. The marvelous Mandarin. That's the same. He uses the brass. The way he uses brass is incredible.
But it is surprising to have that in a violin concerto, right? I mean, you've got trombones doing glissandos, trumpets doing loud flutter tonguing. It's not expected. And I think the tutti passages are very virtuosic for the orchestra. Last movement, he writes frequently ruvido, which is rough, you know? So he wants this kind of teeth.
Aggressivity, but yes, you're right. Maybe that is the only. Maybe with Stravinsky violin concerto, Stravinsky also used winds very in a very nice way. But Berg, Alban Berg concerto, he used the way he uses the winds and brass is completely different. It's very melodic, very lyrical, and it's completely different. Yeah,
you are asking the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra, which is clearly up to it, to play in some very distinctly different styles from beginning to end. The style that the orchestra has to present and work with for the Bernard Herrmann is quite different from the WC, which is wildly different from this. I mean, you're working them hard this week.
Yes, I think so. But me too. It's very demanding for me too. And of course for Juliana. But this is I used to do this kind of programs. I like the 20th century in music. So it's a challenge for everyone, but it's not impossible.
Did you actually program this whole concert?
I think so. Yes.
Yeah. So is there a ribbon that runs through it?
Oh, you mean a thread between the pieces? Debussy and Dukas, obviously, but also with Bartok, because Bartok was deeply influenced by Debussy in his early years. Debussy and Strauss, two of my favorite composers. That's why I love Bartok. And also in the orchestration, this Debussy sound we can find
color.
In the Debussy it's Debussy colored style.
Yeah.
So you're the music director of the Quebec Symphony Orchestra. Mm-hmm. You are co-music director of the Society for Chamber Music Rochester. So I ask my two music directors here, what do you try to accomplish when constructing a season?
Well, I'll take it first because my task is not as big as yours. At Society for Chamber Music in Rochester, we present 5 or 6 programs per year. That's quite different from how many you have to program. But I think we're always looking to, I think all presenting arts organizations are trying to keep your friends and make some new friends. And so that probably involves presenting either works or composers that have some level of familiarity for your audience, and then pushing them to get to know something new. And by new, it doesn't have to mean it was written yesterday. It might just be new to their ears. Just like this Vertigo Suite is not new, but it will be new for our audience. So I think that's an important process.
What do you try to accomplish as you put your seasons together?
I think that that's the same for me. I try to educate, because this is a little bit too pretentious. But I'm trying to, the musical spectrum is so big, so wide. If we only play Brahms, Schumann, Beethoven, Tchaikovsky, that's really limited. It's like if you're going to the museum and you only want to see three or five same pictures, paintings. And of course, when I do a Brahms symphony, for instance, or a Tchaikovsky symphony, or I don't know, Mendelssohn symphony, I try to do something unusual, because that's how you give your audience the opportunity to learn or to know something new. And that's the key. Otherwise, we only play the same things, and after 2, 3, 4 years, the audience is a little bit bored.
and I think depending on what you pair with a masterwork like a Brahms or a Mendelssohn or Tchaikovsky symphony helps the audience to experience that piece in a different way. Also,
of course, but there are so many so many short pieces by Stravinsky which are never played. I try to do some, with the Tchaikovsky symphony or some Prokofiev or some Webern, some rather short pieces, especially when it's 20th century composers like Stravinsky or even Bartok. But I try to mix things.
As it turns out, the two of you actually went to school together.
Well,
we met in Aspen. I was playing in the street to earn money, and I think you were playing across the street.
Maybe earning more money. I'm sorry.
Probably. I'm sorry, because
that's
I was
when
playing
he decided he had to be a conductor.
Yes.
We were at the Aspen Music Festival together. Fabian, I think you just went that one summer.
Yes,
is that
only,
right?
That's the only one.
Was it maybe 2002?
Mm-hmm.
I went for 7 summers. My teacher, Paul Cantor, who I worked with in my undergrad, spent his summers there. And so I just couldn't get enough of the place.
I kept sending you back until you got it right.
Yes, I finally got it right. And actually, the last summer that I went, I had already won my RPO job. And it was kind of a last fun summer as a student, you could say. But funny enough, when you first came to guest conduct, you must have already done your homework and realized, oh, yeah, yeah, I think I knew her.
I know you.
And like... he comes and he gives me a hug. Oh, it's so great to see you. And I'm thinking... What? And I had to think about it for a minute. But then I started to remember the other people that were there, and I realized, oh, yeah. Oh, you? Oh. So we all are connected in
this world.
What
were you doing at Aspen? Was it conducting?
Yes, I was a beginner as a conductor, so I played much more than I was conducting, which is completely strange when you want to learn something. And that's how I started. I tried conducting. That's why I was in Aspen. But if conducting wasn't for me, I would have quit after. But no, I kept.
We're so glad you did.
No, I kept focusing on conducting. Yeah.
So is this your first concerto together?
It is, actually. And I'm very serious when I say that one of the things holding me back initially from agreeing to play a concerto during your week was, but I won't get to play everything else with you. And he said, my dear, sometimes we must make sacrifices. So it's definitely been worth it. And I really couldn't have imagined doing this piece with anyone else. I'm so thankful you wanted to do it. And I hope the audience will love it as much as we do.
I suspect the audience will adore it. But if you would like more information about this concert, you can go to rpo.org. I'm Julia Figueres. Thank you very much, Juliana. Thank you, Fabian. Juliana Thade and Fabian Gabel have taken time to be here. And if you would like to go to the RPO or find out more about the season for this year and coming up soon next year, rpo.org. This broadcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.